We implemented many ITIL processes.
The world's most practiced method for project management.
ITIL has been a catalyst in my career.
Hundreds of thousands of people with a Prince 2 qualification.
I've seen ITIL help organizations be more successful.
The Axelos Podcast, bringing best practice directly to you.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Axelos Global Best Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Akshay Anand, and with me is an absolutely fabulous panel, possibly one of the best panels we've ever put together. And I know I say that every episode, but this time I really, really mean it, because as an ex-consultant, I love talking to other consultants. And today we are talking about IT service management consulting. With consultants both working for both large organizations, boutique organizations, and as independent advisors, we've got a really amazing panel that spans the spectrum of what it means to be in ITSM consulting today. So I'm going to go west to east this time around. Last time, I think I introduced people from east to west. So if I start westernmost, we start with Jessica. We start with Jessica Alfaro, if I'm pronouncing the last name correctly. Jessica has been with a company called Acuity for about 11 and a half years, I think now, going from senior consultant to most recently being promoted to managing director in January. So belatedly, congratulations as well, Jessica. Acuity is a company that does a lot of consulting work with the federal government in the US. Jessica, where can people find out more about yourself and the work that you do with Acuity?
Thank you so much for having me on the panel. I'm really excited to be here. Yeah, so Acuity, if you go to our website, myacuity.com, you'll find information there. And I know that you'll also be sharing our LinkedIn as well. So you can reach out to me on LinkedIn for any additional information about Acuity. So yes, we do a lot of the public sector work, lots of work with Department of Homeland Security, with Department of State, a big focus on IT service management and various other emerging technologies around cloud and data, AI, ML. So really excited about just getting out there and sharing our experiences.
Amazing. If my geography is correct, then I think the next westernmost person is Nathan McDonald from Deloitte UK. Although some of you may recognize him from his work with ITSMF UK over the last couple of years. Nathan has been with Deloitte for, I want to say, close to 14 years at this point, quite a while. Going from senior consultant to director a couple of years ago, if I remember correctly. And Nathan's been part of the service management practice over Deloitte UK for all those years. I'm sure your experience isn't limited to necessarily to just one sector, if I remember how Deloitte works. And so looking forward to having you talk about your experiences across the UK, across Europe, and perhaps even across the world. I'm not sure.
Yeah, thanks, Akshay. Yeah, I mean, I predominantly work in public sector these days, but yeah, indeed, I've sort of worked across sectors in my 14 years at Deloitte. Done a lot of stuff in sort of private financial services as well. And indeed have been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to work on some European and international engagements, like of Sweden, Belgium, the Middle East, and the occasional trip to the States. One of the advantages for working for a multinational firm is the ability to kind of hook up with the global practices now and then and connect with them and work on some of their engagements as well as our own UK-based clients.
Excellent. And the last gentleman needs no introduction. And in terms of geography, I'm sure some of you are wondering, Barclay Ray lives about 2 miles west of me in the sort of the neighboring village town over. Barclay has been a service management consultant for many, many years, not just a consultant, but also a trainer, a coach, an assessor, an auditor. He has a long and deep history with professional services in the IT service management space. Back in the day, he was a leader over at Axios, and then he's been the CEO, I think it was, of ITSMF UK for a number of years. Across all the time, he's also been working on his own independent consulting practice. And I think you can find out more at barclayray.com. I invited Barclay to this podcast for a couple of reasons. The first is, as I said, he's an independent consultant and advisor. But last year, he also put together a short course on management consulting skills. And I think a lot of that is going to come into play during our discussion here. And we should hopefully be able to mine Barclay for some of his gems of wisdom. So Barclay, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. Actually, really good to be here with the others as well. And hopefully we'll have a good discussion that covers a number of different aspects of consulting, which I have been doing for, as you say, a number of years. I started as an independent in 1994 and have had various, yes, I'm that old, I've had various roles or jobs since then with ITSMF, as you mentioned. Obviously, I really for 30 years, I have worked closely with the Service Desk Institute, worked with yourselves at Axelos and others over the years. So, yeah, a variety of experience. I've actually had that course for a number of years. I just sort of refreshed it last year, but I have delivered it in many cases to not just consultants, but to salespeople and to, you know, I think consultancy and selling are sort of on the same spectrum, and there's a lot of aspects of both that can help each other.
Well, I think I don't think you have to necessarily have consultant in your title to have a consulting mindset. I think, and this is something that we're going to be discussing later on in the call, the sort of skills you need and how those skills are not necessarily applicable only to people with consulting in their titles. But I think we should really start by talking about the word consulting itself, because in my experience, many people have their own opinion of what is consulting and what isn't consulting. And so maybe we should start there, just level setting the term itself. Jessica, I'll come to you first. In your experience, what do you think is consulting and how do you think it might be different from some of the other similar professional services out there?
Yeah, so this is a topic that we introduce in our orientation when we bring on new employees. We talk about consulting 101. And so this is an area that I actually, you know, provide that introduction to our new workforce. And it's knowledge. That's where I usually start with it. You're bringing a certain skill set and knowledge to the table. And so I know that we're going to get into some of the nuances of management consulting, technical consulting, different types of consulting. And so we also have those different flavors at Acuity as well. And so we talk about how, if you are a management consultant, what type of skills you're bringing to the table in solving our different challenges that our clients are dealing with. And then from the technical perspective, you know, that skill set and that knowledge that you bring to the table and on the technical side. So definitely it's that knowledge, it's that confidence in being able to speak about a certain topic and bringing that solution to bear. And I think just, you know, I use the example of, we use consultants all the time. If it's financial consultants or, you know, we're always reaching out to someone who has a specific expertise in a certain area to get their insight and knowledge, just things that we wouldn't necessarily think about. They just live in that area all the time. So I look at it as very similar. It's just what exactly you're knowledgeable and skilled in. So that's my two cents on that.
That is an interesting perspective. So in that case, how, Nathan, I guess the question for you, how would we distinguish between consulting and advisory? Because those are two, I mean, they're two different words, they're used in different contexts. Is there a great deal of difference between consulting and advisory?
It's interesting, actually, because when you sent out the kind of prep for this, I was thinking about that with myself, and I think it's a very, very fine line for me, you know, between what you might call consulting and advisory work, you know, and I would say a large part of what I do is actually advising my clients on the right sort of direction to go, the right sort of things to think about when they're trying to tackle some of their transformational challenges, be it very service management focused and specific or more generally for their technology organizations. And so I see a lot of being a consultant about giving people advice, guidance, support based on my experience, my knowledge, my expertise that I've built up as an individual, but being able to also leverage that wider kind of knowledge, experience and expertise of the firm I work for, and indeed the other organizations I have the sort of benefit, the opportunity to engage with through my firm, but also through my sort of personal connections and network I've built up over the years. So I'm not sure that I massively see a difference between consulting and advisory as the nature of the type of work I do. I think it's more interesting when I think about it in terms of the type of consulting and type of advisory support I give to clients about, you know, is it technical related? Is it management? Is it strategic? And kind of technical and management for me are both a bit more tactical. They're more like hands-on, being more specific in the advice and guidance I'm giving, helping to kind of shape and helping support the delivery of that advice. The strategic side of consulting is maybe more about going, you know, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? What about bringing these things to the table? You know, helping to shape ideas and form ideas with a client, which is, I think, more inherently advisory in nature than, and certainly when you get into the more technical and delivery aspects of consulting, where you're actually helping to, say, build a platform, build a product or solution. And in my time, I've done that as well around, you know, various sort of ITSM platforms, for example. So I think for me, actually, no, I don't see a massive difference between consulting as a term and advisory as a term in terms of sort of the core nature of what I do. I think those two things go hand in hand.
And there's a third term that we tend to see in the market in the ecosystem and the market, which is coaching. And I know, Barclay, you sometimes talk about coaching and providing coaching and so on. And do you think there's a difference between consulting and coaching?
Yes, definitely. I mean, coaching has got some quite specific connotations to it in terms of individual sort of one-to-one development with people. I see consulting very much in the advisory sphere, to be honest, in terms of just what we've been talking about there. And I think I've probably seen more of an issue in terms of division of definition and so on with how we might view contracting and project work. I mean, I kind of break it into three things: the temporary or interim person. So you need a resource to do something you need, which you don't have permanently. The sort of plumber type resource. You know, you need somebody who knows, who's got a very specific skill set to do something very specific, and then kind of go. And then the third one, which is a bit more controversial, which is where I probably place myself, which is the Mary Poppins theory of consulting, which is the advisor, the consultant who comes in and looks at a situation and helps you to solve it yourself.
So the person who comes in with a spoonful of sugar.
Well, the spoonful of sugar helps, but it's actually, if you look at Mary Poppins, the film, it's a dysfunctional family. They don't realize their issues. She comes in and she doesn't actually do anything really. She just kind of helps them to see what they're doing wrong. And she guides them here and there and points them in the right direction, makes them see things so that they take ownership of it themselves and then go forward with it. And then rather brutally, they kind of ignore her and dump her when she's finished, and and she goes off to the next job when the wind changes. And it's a bit of a sort of slightly glib example, but it does highlight, I think, the real difference between what we very often see as consulting, where you have an organization going in and piling in with lots of people and doing stuff, which I think tends to be more about actually delivery and whatever you want to call it, project management, transformation, etc. And actually pure consulting, which is really analyzing the situation and trying to work with the client so that they actually develop the solution themselves. And if you take that to coaching, then it is working very much one-to-one with individuals to help them to do the right thing, I guess.
Okay, interesting. So do we as a panel think that there's variances from sector to sector about how these different types of services play out. So Jessica, Acuity does a lot of work in public sector, as you mentioned, federal government, and I think you mentioned Homeland Security and a few other things. Do you see a difference in how you have to approach public sector work versus, you know, commercial or for-profit work?
I do. So that was an interesting perspective that you gave, and that Mary Poppins scenario. And so I, you know, just thinking about that in the federal government, you know, so our consulting is more on that delivery project management side. We are responsible for that transformation. So they have contracted us to come in, and, you know, we are providing that guidance and advisory support. But I think the difference there is the government kind of knows what they, so they've, there is already an ask that in some type of objectives and vision that they're looking for. And so we're there to help get them to that vision and the actual implementation of that solution. So really more of the taking on the ownership. There isn't really anyone that I can advise and hand that to that's going to take that on and run with it. So I think that's the big difference in a, you know, in our federal contracting world, is that we're the doers. So we're taking all of this knowledge that we know and best practice and, you know, all of the industry lessons learned, and we're using that to help move them forward.
So Nathan, would you agree with that? I mean, or do you have a different perspective? Because I think you've done quite a lot of work across different sectors. Do you see a difference in how ITSM consulting works across different sectors?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, this, actually, because I don't think I see a different way into the way in which I do what I do. So, you know, across the different sectors I've worked in, the kind of approach I take, the way I kind of try to go in, work with a client, you know, don't want to ever kind of leave a client with a sense of I'm doing something to them. I kind of want to, you know, work with them and make sure the client team's a part of the team that I'm bringing to bear. And that kind of approach I take to delivering with the client, I don't think changes by sector. I think the way in which the clients engage with us does, though, and the way in which they use consultants changes. And I'm saying that very much from that ITSM angle, right? I think that, you know, the approach to ITSM, or the approach to sort of technology consulting, I think more generally, doesn't necessarily change by sector in terms of what we do, how we do it, the way we should engage. I think the way in which the sectors pull on us and use us varies based on the level of availability of those skills, experiences, et cetera, in the sectors, and the ease through which they can access some of that skills and experience through other means, you know, either through sort of direct hiring and building capability themselves versus ability to access external resources to be able to consume directly with their own kind of sort of people and capabilities. Versus, you know that when they bring us in and what they bring us in to do as well, right? And how far they'll bring us in to go. You know, I find in some sectors, in the private sector world, the commercial world, they're more mature at using consultants in the strategic advisory space, you know, as we were talking about before, or versus the delivery space. You know, if they bring us in for delivery, it's very specific, very and very contained. In the sort of public sector work I do, you know, we tend to come in with a bit of a broader remit and often a broader teams. I think the second way, the way I would answer this question slightly differently, is when I'm thinking about this more holistically, and I kind of broaden it outside of pure ITSM. You know, I think one of the things that's really important and is still important from an ITSM perspective, but actually is about understanding the business, my ability to call upon people in, you know, and one of the advantages of working for a big firm is my ability to call on people who've got experience of working with specific industries and specific sub-industries therein, who've got real deep business knowledge. And so being able to sort of me talk about, you know, good practice for service design in a general ITSM context, you know, great, and I can bring that experience to bear, but actually being able to translate that into an understanding of how that is applicable to the businesses that I'm trying to support is where I, you know, if I was working outside of my own sector, I would look to the wider firm to help bring some of that knowledge to bear. I think that's quite important.
That's a fair point. I mean, I think the drivers of the of those companies, those industry drivers of those companies, need to be integrated in a seamless way into whatever solutions you're building or whatever advice you're building. So I think domain knowledge is quite key. And related to that, Barclay, you've worked in as an independent consultant and coach and advisor, and you've also worked as heading up professional services for fairly large companies. Do you see a difference in how ITSM consulting plays out depending on the size of that consulting services provider?
The size of the provider does make a difference. I mean, from just purely from a business point of view and a business model point of view, just selling and delivering consulting is actually a very, very difficult business. You need other things. I mean, I think that's why it's great if you've got another string like training or membership and subscription and other things that can keep the business going. Just pure consulting is very difficult to sustain as in a long-term way, in a predictable way, in terms of that you can manage the workforce and the headcount and so on. I think that one of the things coming out of the discussion here is about how we sell and how people buy consulting. And the big difference, I think, between the public sector and the private sector is actually how they buy consulting. And a lot of that is down to the maturity. And I think, as Nathan was saying, that you go to some private sector organizations, you know, that are very mature and know what they want, but also are, in some ways, can be quite open about what they would expect from consulting. Whereas I think a lot of public sector, the way that they have to buy limits the scope of that, certainly from somebody where I sit in the food chain, where a lot of it is about getting in front of them, spending some time understanding what they need to do, and being able to sort of mold that. In the sort of tender situation, it can be quite difficult to do that in a way that certainly that works for me, and it can be quite challenging. But it's also about, I think a lot of what we do in consulting does depend on how it's sold, what is actually sold, what is in that scope of work, what is in the proposal, what's in the brief that actually lays out the objectives and the deliverables that will be provided. And again, if you are going into a situation where, like I think as Jessica was saying, where they've already made some decisions about stuff when you're going in to do it, that can be quite challenging depending on the scale of your organization. If that doesn't quite work with, you know, what, and maybe a good buying process probably will tease all that out, you know, in terms of the fit. But, you know, I can imagine there's lots of situations where I've been asked to do things where I'm maybe not too comfortable because, the strategic bit has either already been done or maybe hasn't been done or it's been assumed to be done. And then you're just asked to go and get on with something and you're like, well, hang on, I need to step back and do some discovery and analysis and so on. And that hasn't actually happened. And that's where the challenges come, I think. And for me, I'm always just, no, I'm not going in there unless I've got the opportunity to spend even just a few days looking at it, sitting down, agreeing with the stakeholders what we're there to do. And in some cases, I've not turned down work where I've just been asked to do stuff that, and, you know, to me, it didn't make sense or it wasn't clear as to how that would be delivered.
I think that's a good point, in that different industries have different sort of strategy cycles. And I think especially larger government type organizations have longer strategy cycles, which then plays out with longer procurement processes because they've got to try to engineer a procurement process that works in or will continue to work for a much longer time frame, as opposed to, you know, dare I say, an agile organization, quote unquote.
Can I give you an example there? Don't use the word agile, you know, just...
Don't use the word agile when contrasting with public sector. I got it.
Yeah. Okay. It was just one organization. Of years ago, I was asked to do some work, and we actually spent quite a lot of time doing the brief. It was public. It was a global public sector organization, one that's very well current at the moment in terms of its awareness.
I wonder who that could be.
Well, there's a good word. there was a point where there was a lot of things that needed to be done, and actually, I realized that the scope of the consultancy was to do what the want to say what they wanted me to say and then move on, and I didn't, and I said this is what you need to do and this is what, and we kind of got there in the end, we got paid, but it didn't sort of lead on. And it was about literally 5 or 6 years later that I was then asked back to say, oh, we moved the management, the whole thing changed, and we took your report and actually built the thing based on that, and can you come back and do some. And you know, that to me is the kind of cycle that we're in sometimes. We can't, you know, just in terms of the job satisfaction, it's on a 20-year job cycle, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that actually there's a lot that you can do, and then there's a point where it just goes, well, we're going to do it this way. And if you're doing advisory and strategic, then you've got to be accept that they might not accept your recommendations if you're being honest to them and doing the right thing. But hopefully that will come back and reward you at some point. It doesn't always happen, but you know that the way that they buy and the way that they actually use it does vary significantly.
Fair point. So I think,
I was just going to jump in there, right? Because I think one of the things that's really interesting is in you know, as I said, as I have increasingly focused on public sector myself over the past sort of 5 years or so, is actually how much further along in the UK you know, government organizations have got in being able to introduce more flexibility into the way they go to market, and recognizing the way in which they can better benefit from the use of consultants and indeed the use of SMEs as well in that capacity. And to kind of, to borrow your phrase, Akshay, give themselves more agility and flexibility in terms of the way they use those suppliers. It has been something that has noticeably changed. But at the same time, they are still governed and regulated by the frameworks under which they buy those services, right? And ultimately are sort of responsible to the taxpayer for how they're consuming public funds. And therefore they have to be more diligent and more careful in how they go out to market. And you do end up in situations sometimes where you see a tender come out for public sector work and you look at it and go, you know, I'm not really sure what you're asking for. And it's harder to then have a conversation with them about, Can you give me some more details behind this so I understand the strategy that's led you to ask for this, in a way that when you're dealing with a private sector organization or a financial service organization, you can be a bit more flexible and get more understanding up front as part of that initial procurement process than sometimes public sector organizations are able to be.
Fair enough. So I'm sure at this point our consultants are going to say, you know what, this sort of work sounds really interesting. So how can I get into this sort of work? What sort of skills do I need? What sort of training do I need? And, you know, let's start with the US perspective on this one. And Jessica, as you've been building out your teams and you continue to build out those teams, what are some of the skills that you look for? Is it different when you're hiring graduates from, you know, undergraduate degrees? Is it different when you're trying to recruit a senior person? Are there common patterns that we can talk about? How would you talk about the skills you think are important?
So, you know, just looking at our different strategies that we have at Acuity, and, you know, we hire a wide range of, you know, straight from college and then also senior level, you know, individuals that have that deep technical knowledge. And so, yeah, there's some common themes that we see that we're looking for that I think are, you know, regardless of what skill level, and just, you know, being a go-getter, you know, that confidence, someone who has got that mind, that growth mindset, that they're willing to learn, that they can quickly, you know, pick up a new solution and you know, do what it takes to research and learn it. You know, their communication skills, you know, their ability to speak in front of a group of people, you know, how they write, you know, a lot of those communication skills, I think, are key. And then from, you know, a junior level entry person that we're looking for, you know, there are definitely some areas that we look to grow them, and just an understanding of it. So we kind of bring them through a boot camp. We have a boot camp program at Acuity that, you know, we're looking to grow certain skills. So it's, you know, understanding of federal contracting, you know, is one. So with the lay of the land and just the terms that you're going to hear, you know, we show them ITIL. So we help them understand, here are some terms and you know, acronyms that you're going to hear. Here's a just a base understanding of how your role may interact in that larger enterprise view. You know, we talk about CMMI and just how you mature and you grow in that. You know, there will be some basic technical skills that we may share, and just, you know, here are some things that you will need to know, depending on, you know, if you're going to be more of a business analyst or, you know, more on that technical side. So definitely, you know, in that entry level, those are going to be some of the skills that we're looking for, you know, just that customer interaction. How do you interact with customers and just co-create with them and establish good relationships with them? And then obviously on the more senior level side, that deep technical knowledge is definitely something that we're looking for. And just that mentoring and coaching ability. So we want our senior level folks that bring that deep knowledge to share and feel comfortable working with their peers and being able to help coach them and bring them up on similar skills that they have. So definitely that team, just feeling comfortable working in a team, we're definitely one of those groups that we want to foster team collaboration as much as possible. And so if we find someone who is somewhat of an introvert that doesn't really want to be around a big group of people and share, and they just kind of want to be in a room, you know, coding, or, you know, that right. may not be a good fit. So definitely someone who can be a good team fit. So those are all some of the things that we evaluate when we're looking at bringing on new staff onto our.
There's one attribute you didn't mention, and I'm wondering whether I'm thinking of that attribute because I'm just cynical. But I want to open up the same question to Nathan and Barclay to see whether you happen to mention this one attribute that would you like to add to what Jessica said? I mean, I think we're broadly in agreement. I could see everyone's heads nodding. But are there any other things that you think are important to highlight?
Can I add a couple of things, and sure. I'll leave Nathan to finish. People ask me very often, you know, particularly if they've done a project or two, and they very often come to me and say, how do you get to be a consultant or whatever? And I say professionalism, ethics, and lifestyle. And you don't necessarily want to take the credit for, you know, you don't mind not being the seen as the hero all the time, that you're actually a kingmaker rather than a king or a queen, whatever. I my analogy is more to do with music, which is definitely not lead guitarist, definitely not lead front singer, maybe the keyboard player, you know, actually who actually does all the arranging and sorts all that kind of stuff out, and maybe still jumps up and down occasionally in front of people. But probably
as long as you don't have a keytar, Ben.
Sorry?
As long as you don't have a keytar. You know, the hybrid keyboard that looked like a guitar that was
in the 1980s. Juki stick. But just on, so professionalism is all the things that Jessica's mentioned about communication and ability to listen more than anything. You know, not being the going in and being the big. I'm going to go in and sort it out. I'm going to be the hero. I'm going to let them win, and my success comes from the fact that they have succeeded.
Right.
We've got paid. We've got a good case study and a good story, and we might get asked back. They can't really ask for any more than that. But ethics as well, and integrity, and just being able, you know, being consistent and having a code of some kind of code of practice that says, you know, that that we're very clear on the rules, because there are, as a consultant, you do go in and you do get the opportunities to see, you know, different perspectives on what people are doing. And you've got to put yourself always in the position of doing the right thing for your client.
Right.
That might be painful, because you might have to tell them that they, you know, they need to do better or differently. But, you know,
Or you just walk away from projects at times.
Or you walk away. And then lifestyle, are you willing to, you know, post pictures of depressing hotel room views on Facebook, which is what I do. But, you know, that whole thing of just actually your lifestyle will be impacted by this. Are you ready? And I've had some people that work for me over the years where they were brilliant at all the other stuff, but actually they couldn't hack the lifestyle. And so that's important as well. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Nathan, anything that you think needs to be thrown into the mix?
I think it's difficult, right? You know, 'cause I think good points made by Jessica and Barclay. You know, I think when thinking about the kind of base question, communication, you know, was one of the kind of key things that came across to me. But in that sense, all different aspects of it. And I'm not saying that someone has to be a really confident and outgoing personality and speaker, right? You know, actually, one of the advantages of working for a larger organization is I love the diversity of the different types of skills, capabilities that we are able to bring to bear and give people homes for within the organization. And using those different perspectives from, you know, different backgrounds, from different experiences to understand different ways of coming up with a solution to a problem or a solution to a question from a client. So, you know, I think that, you know, hiring people at different sort of levels of experience, different backgrounds, different, you know, educational backgrounds and levels and all those types of things, you know, adds to that, you know, incredibly sort of diverse workforce. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of key attributes we look for in terms of being able to align to sort of our core values and, you know, and just reiterating really some of the things that Jessica and Barclay said again around, you know, our ethics, you know, our approach to working with our clients, you know, that sense of working with them rather than, you know, going in and doing things to them are all sort of incredibly important. And we want people that you know, bring those things to bear and those kind of motivations and behaviours to bear in their own approaches to work, you know, whatever their background. And I think one of the best experiences I've had in my life over the past 5 years is when we started our Bright Start program, which is bringing in people at sort of 18, 19 years old, direct from college prior to university degrees, and just the completely different perspective that they brought into our organization and the energy and enthusiasm to come in and do this as their kind of next step in their learning and development as an individual. And it's great to have that again, that kind of added diversity into our workplace that we can bring to bear for our clients.
I know I said there was one word that I was thinking of, and Barclay was starting to edge towards that, and I thought it might be interesting to maybe discuss that before we take our break. And that word is endurance. Because at least in my consulting experience, there have been a lot of late nights, a lot of weekends away from home. And it's not just the horrible hotel view sort of thing, but it's, you know, I remember being told, look, one of the most physically and mentally demanding projects, but also one in which I made very deep friendships with other members of my team. This was when I was back in the US, and I had to fly from New York to Overland Park in Kansas, and that was almost like an 8-hour journey end to end, after which I had to put in 8 hours of work because that's what the client was expecting and that was what we were billing. get back to the hotel room, and after dinner, catch up on all the back end work, which included responding to RFPs, et cetera, et cetera. Because one of the things in consulting is you can go from feast to famine and back very, very quickly. And one of the things I saw consistently across all the consultants that I worked with who succeeded and thrived in that environment was that endurance, that mental fortitude, the physical fortitude. And for some people, it was too much. Has the world changed? Am I being just cynical based on my experiences back in the day, or has the world actually changed?
I think if I can jump in there, because I think when I heard you say that, I immediately jumped to, you know, not defensive, but a kind of sense of, yes, the world is changing, right? I think if I look back at my last 2 or 3 years, when, you know, certainly Barclay and actually on this call know how much I have been able to improve my physical and mental well-being over the last 2 years, and my organization has been key to supporting me in doing that, and they've been fantastic as an employer in that regard. It is actually recognizing the fact that having a diverse and inclusive workforce, and the workforce that is able to be productive and is in the right place from a physical and mental well-being perspective, means that we need to recognize how people's work-life balance is a key integral part of how we deliver, and therefore that kind of old, if you forgive the sort of parlance, that old school thinking.
Oh, I'm old. It's fine. You can say old school.
The consulting life was, you know, hotels and 4 or 5 days on the road a week, is going away, right? You know, and actually the proof of that has been the horrendously challenging situation we found ourselves in the last 12 to 18 months with COVID, where we have proven our capabilities to deliver what we do without having to be on client site 5 days a week, or 4 days a week even. You know, it's, you know, we can do our roles as consultants remotely. We can work from home. We can work from our offices. We can maintain our work-life balance in that respect in a way that, you know, some of those kind of old cliches about consulting start to go away. And I don't believe that the future of consulting in the next 12 to 18 months will see an immediate shift back to any of those bad behaviors. I think we will get into a situation where, yes, people are going to want to go back to the office for again, their well-being reasons, and in order to enable better collaboration in some respects. But actually, working remotely, giving people more flexibility in their workplace and where they work from going forward is going to be as much a part of a consultant's life as it will be for everyone else.
Okay, fair enough. On that note, let's take a quick break, and when we'll come back, we'll resume the conversation. Hi everyone, Akshay here. Sorry to interrupt the podcast, but as you know, every episode we'd like to bring you a profile of someone interesting in our global IT service management community. And today it gives me great pleasure to highlight Paula Martinen. And I probably butchered that last name. So Paula, if you're listening to this, I really apologize. But Paula Martinen is based in Finland. I met her on the IT service management conference circuit, I think first at ITSMF UK some years ago. And she's a lovely person. She's very good at sharing her experience, sharing her expertise and advice with a lot of people in the community, and participating and supporting a lot of events, especially those that she works on at ITSMF Finland. So without any further ado, let's hear from Paula.
Hello, my name is Paula Mattanen, and I work currently at Tietoevry Finland. And my work there, I am a senior solution architect in SIAM ITSM tools team. Mainly the focus area for me is ServiceNow implementations, and that is only for the customer ServiceNow environments, not our own environment, but also that the customers, that how they are integrated towards our services. And that is what I do for the daily life. And also then as a volunteer job here in Finland, We have ITSMF Finland membership that is fully 100% here, voluntary drop action, what we do. And I have been there involved several years. This is second time that I am there in the board. And meanwhile, while I stepped out first time from the board, I still continued with these special interest groups works. And before I was even first time in the board, I have been involved with these ITSMF Finland conferences. So I started there 2009, I think, or 2010. And so IT-related hobby. So that's what I do. And how I turned to be in IT, I actually were earlier in retail and responsible of the IT systems in retail. And then I went to Michael Jackson's concert, and there in the toilet queue, I was actually requested to join to IT for the service desk where they supported IT, where they supported retail shops. And they wanted to have someone who is able to speak the customer language. So user experience was also a hot topic in that time. Because there was a need to get someone translate the technician discussion towards the customer language. Some of the challenges what I have faced, of course, when I started in IT, something like 98, and then started working there. I started in service desk, and we had a team. For the service desk team, and our service was for the customers where they were from gasoline stations, so it was very a male dominated environment, and in that time it wasn't that common that, of course, there was in service desks there were several times females, but not as a specialists. And when I answered the phone when customer called, they were asking that, Can you put me for the specialists? And it happened several times. I tried to explain that, yes, I am able to help you. Can I help you? That can you please describe the topic for me? And then they started to learn this in the hard way, that when I then agreed, okay, I will transfer for some of my colleagues, and the guys were asking me to help them, that how they are able to resolve the situation. And when the customers heard my voice from the background, that, okay, that is the one who we ignored, that she's the one who is anyway talking here and helping to resolve this case. So they understood that it is possible that females can be specialists. For luck, things has changed a lot after that, and it is totally a different environment nowadays. I think one of the best advice is to be brave and trust yourself, and also that when someone else is having a different opinion than you, that to cooperate more with that and learn from each other. There is normally reason behind of that being a different opinion or having this different opinion, and how you can learn from that. I had the situation many, many years ago when we had someone, we were always thinking that she's always only complaining, and we were thinking that why she's complaining that much. And I wanted to discuss straight with her, and what is this topic here behind? And she said that others feels that she is so brave that they came to her and asked her to tell to the managers that what is wrong in the environment. She was the voice of many, several persons, because they didn't dare to speak. And then she also said that discussing this together, we realized that if she wouldn't have told these topics to us, we wouldn't have noticed to make the corrections and improvements for those topics. So be brave and trust yourself. And even you don't always have to be, have the same opinion with others, but all, when someone is having that different opinion and is complaining, telling these things, thank them, because that is the way how you can make things happen, how you are able to notify the things which needs improvement. I'm easily able to reach out for besties via the LinkedIn, and then also from Facebook back to ITSM forum. There is also a lot of discussions what people are going through. So via those platforms, and of course, in LinkedIn, I have my email address available there, so it's visible that it's able to utilize also from there.
All right, welcome back. So we've been talking about ITSM consulting in this episode. Let's say put ourselves in the shoes of a newly minted consultant, a fresh graduate who's joined a new company, perhaps a company that we have on the, represented on the call here. What do the sort of projects or assignments look like? I mean, are they going to be large teams? Are they going to be days, weeks, months, years? Can we even talk about atypical engagement? Barclay, I'll come to you first with that. How would you describe consulting and projects to people who want to know more about it?
Well, I think before the break, Nathan was talking about, you know, just the impact of COVID and change the way of working. And I totally agree with all of that. Having spent the last 25 years pretty much on the road, but not in the way that we've been talking about as 5 days a week in the same place. It's been much more a mix, and I'm never out for 5 days, but I do think that will change. I do have a concern about the type of how we will do some of the things where I certainly know from my own perspective, I know I've been able to add value, which is to actually observe people, not just by talking to them and asking them questions or looking at data, but also observe them in the workplace and how they interact with each other. And that bit has been missing for me for a year, and I found it very difficult to be able to bridge that and find different ways of doing it. So I do think that we will still need to have periodic or, you know, some kind of way of actually engaging with people directly. Now, that's easy for me to say because that's probably the way I've done it for a long time anyway, which is I go on site for 2 days, 3 days, never more than five, and get a lot of information, do the thing that I like with at that point about we don't have to be gregarious. You can be a bit of an introvert, but the main thing is you build trust one way or another. And there are some people that can do that very quickly, just in a few days, and others who take a bit of time. But I think the type of work will then, you know, I mean, it's very difficult to throw new people into those kind of strategic, you know, you're on site for 3 days, you've got to find out stuff. The oil well is going crazy. You need to cap it, and then you need to find out what's happened. And that sort of thing, that kind of work is very difficult, I think, to do on Teams or Zoom. I think you need to be there and understand. And also you need to be experienced. So I think for people going into the work, then they'll probably start through the research support type roles and kind of move on from there. I think having models is great. I think organizations that have got, whether it's tools, whether it's, you know, whether it's using specific frameworks and training and so on, or building their own models with tool sets and approaches, they are very helpful. They don't work for everybody, but they do give people structure in how they work. So I think if you give people the opportunity to not worry too much about, you know, their own approach to information gathering, you give them something where they can find that, and then they use their initiative to pull in the other bits rather than just chucking them in at the deep end when they're young and inexperienced, I think that's good. But I definitely think that the old model, and we're talking about old, and yes, I am old as well. The model where we say we go in with somebody who's bright and you know, is the kind of forest clearer, kills a few crocodiles, you know, establishes a bit of a base camp, and then you bring in lots of other people to do stuff. I think that model is probably going to change, because I think organizations do want more of the, you know, and here we go, co-creation. They do want to be given and enabled to do these things themselves. They'll always have projects where they need to move forward quickly. But I think
so we're moving away from the land and expand type of model.
Land and expand, and you know, we're in there for 400 days, you know, and there's 10 people on it. That model, I think, has got to change and has got to evolve in a way that it's, you know, and it probably is in the public sector we were describing it. It probably is very transparent, but it's not always seen as being transparent. You know, it's viewed, well, let's get somebody in for 20 days work, and then we know that they're going to write us a proposal for 500. Actually, up front, it should be, well, we know that we're going to be needing this work. And of course, that's the way it works. But I think that that old land and expand model has got to evolve. And I think we've got to develop people that can do more with less and more quickly, put it that way.
So we were just talking about public sector. So, of course, Jessica, I'm going to come to you with this same question. You mentioned a boot camp and other bits. How would you describe, you know, the sort of quote unquote typical engagement to your new staff, if indeed you can even describe what a typical engagement might be?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about the way, you know, the U.S. government buys and services, and so a lot of the, you know, so depending on how large the scope is, we've seen very large teams of, you know, 100 people, and then very small teams of a couple of people. So really depending on the scope and what they're buying. And it usually is a base year of a year and option years up to 5 years. So it really depends. So that, you know, what Barclay was mentioning about, you know, you're there and, you know, for a short period of time or only for a few days a week. For us, it's slightly different in that we have teams that they are there on the client site all week. They are billing 80, you know, 40 hours a week to the client to, you know, drive them to whatever those objectives are. You know, obviously we're co-creating and working with them to get them there, but it is so that model exists of, you know, they are directly focused on delivery. And that's where they go every day. Now, obviously, with COVID and the situation now, most of our clients are, we're all virtual at this point, which is a big shift from what it used to be. Our clients wanted to see us on site almost every day. So now that this has pushed us to this 100% virtual environment, which, you know, is a huge change in, you know, our contracting model, I think it's working out very well. They're able to see that we're productive and we're able to do things and still, you know, drive value to them. But so our consulting is slightly different in that. So I would say that's a big difference from what I'm hearing on this panel, just, you know, that model of, you know, we're on site, we're there. We do want our folks that are doing delivery to also provide some time out of their 40-hour week as reach back to our corporate in corporate initiatives, if it's responding to proposals or other, you know, tech challenges or things that we may have going on to continue to do the skills development. But yeah, that's predominantly, you know, they're that delivery focus.
So Nathan, would you say it's fair to say that at this point in time, for lack of a better phrase, any ITSM consulting engagement will have a tools component to it? Or do you think there's still enough of the sort of not necessarily strategy work, but sort of the pure process consulting, to use the phrase from back in the day? Because the way I sometimes think about it is, You know, and I remember we were having this discussion back when, you know, we were starting to work through the initial ITIL 4 workshops, that a process documentation or process reengineering work by itself has very limited value, because it becomes real only when it gets put into whatever tool set and starts to operate at scale. So when it comes to ITSM consulting, in your experience, do you think that we're at a stage in the evolution of our industry that a tools implementation will be part and parcel of any ITSM engagement?
So I'm going to answer that question firstly. Hopefully you can hear me above purring. by saying bluntly, no. And that's because I have always and will always maintain that ITSM consulting is about understanding how your technology organization needs to deliver for the business that it's part of. You know, and whether or not you call that ITSM or you call it technology operating model or you call it tech strategy, fundamentally those are all broadly the same thing to me. The way in which some organizations look at ITSM and treat ITSM, it has become quite synonymous with your big tooling vendors and tooling platforms, and I get that, and I understand that, but the broader sense of the term to me still means working out how you should shape your technology organization, what services it should deliver, what tools it should have, what technology it should be using, what people with what skills and capabilities it should have, what culture and behaviors you want it to exhibit in order to deliver what the business that it is part of is required of it. And so, you know, in that context, then you need your you know, your organization to have the capability to do all those parts of that, to what extent, you know, you get involved in the different bits. That said, there is absolutely a core play in the ITSM world around, you know, implementing effective tooling solutions to support some of those traditional deployments of service management practices and capabilities, you know, your incident management, problem management, change management, you know, et cetera, which are the kind of bread and butter of the old ITIL world, that were so well received within most organizations that it's still kind of, still fundamental. But those more kind of strategic components about, you know, organizational change management, you know, service design, portfolio management, that they have much wider ramifications than, you know, in terms of the overall delivery of your organization than simply looking at what tool you need to support them.
The reason I ask this is because, you know, if I look through my sort of LinkedIn network at, you know, some of the people I used to work with back in the day, some of the organizations I used to work at or work with, they all state that they are a consulting organization, but invariably they're all, or a vast majority of them are basically doing, leading with a bit of consulting, but the majority of that project delivery is around ServiceNow, Remedy, Atlassian, you name it, some sort of a tool set. And that's where I was coming from with that question. I see everyone nodding quite violently in agreement here. So clearly I'm onto something.
It concerns me in the market at the moment. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
You broke up there. Now, it's the area that does concern me, because it there is a bit of a confusion around, and that's where the definitions of consulting, contracting, coaching, tool implementation, I think, really matter. I do quite a lot of work with various types of vendors and usually, you know, implementation organizations, and looking at their value propositions and how they sell and all things like that to help them. And invariably, if I do get involved with sales discussions or I'm sitting in the back of a sales call, you know, I do get worried sometimes that it does get way too much driven by the technology. There's the assumption that technology is just going to do all this stuff. And by the way, we've got lots of people who are really experienced, know how to do it, and we'll just get on and do it for you. In many cases, 70-80% of that might actually be applicable, but there's certain stages that you need to go through. And I think a lot of the, if you like, some of those organizations that you're talking about, actually, that where there's been this explosion of companies who are doing that kind of work. And I'm not really talking about the big guys, but lots of companies where it's like it's based on the practice around a particular tool or tool sets. It's great business while it's going, but you know, you come around the cycle again. How much have they thought about what Nathan was saying about the people side and the structure and the culture and the organizational change management? If you don't give some credence to that, then the implementation, as we know, will probably not work as well as it should. And if you're talking about ITSM consult, I mean, I haven't written a process for years. Most vast majority of what I do is just help people to see what they need to do and what kind of people are best suited to do it, and you know, help them to write, very often write content about how they communicate it and just things like that to get the organizational change management bit really working well. Because so much of the other stuff is now commodity, you know, how you put in any of these tools and how many, and there's much more of a move towards using them much more out of the box, which helps, I think, as well. But that is a concern. It's still that there's still that concern that the tool will solve everything, and actually then you get organizations with people who maybe in all the descriptions that we've made up to now about, you know, good communication skills, listening, facilitation, public speaking, all the other bits about, you know, building trust, a lot of the guys there might not have that background or might not have those skills. And that worries me, that are those things then being done? I know that because I've run teams myself where I've got technical guys who are very good, but actually they don't really know how to do a risk analysis. They don't really know how to build a stakeholder analysis. They don't know how to, you know, mitigate a debate or an argument. So all those things are important parts of consulting that really make the difference.
That's a fair point. I think we have just about enough time for one more question. How would you describe the benefits of being a consultant? How has being a consultant changed your life, changed your career? So Jessica, if you don't mind, I'll come to you first with that question. How would you describe the sort of positive effects that consulting has brought into your life?
It's been life-changing, if I were to say in a very short, definitely didn't think that this would be the path that I would go down. I knew I liked technology, and coming into my first, you know, contracting gig, it was an introduction to ITIL. It was, what's configuration management? What's a service management tool? How do you use it? How do you train it? How do you get adoption and drive value? And so my entire career for the past 18 plus years has been in that world. And it's been amazing. It's been an amazing journey, and it's constantly evolving. And I think that's what's really exciting about it. In just hearing this conversation and how you mesh process and technology and really driving that value, that's where, you know, and hearing, you know, like Nathan and Barclay talk about teams and how you bring all of these different skill sets together and knowing where your weaknesses are and where other strengths are, and you're able to leverage and know, I know somebody who has that answer. And so just building that team synergy to be able to, you know, just, you know, have a high performing team. I think that's all been very exciting for me, and just how you pull that together and really get others excited about it. We talked a little bit about the, you know, my world was predominantly process. But our clients are always talking about the technology, and they want to know, how do you bridge the gap? And so I can't just come to the table with a process. I have to show them how it's applicable to the technology that they have, how we can integrate the solutions to create more knowledge and all of that kind of stuff. And now, as we're driving into, you know, the whole ITIL 4 model with, you know, digital transformation and all of that kind of stuff, and the emerging trends that are going on and new ways of working, I think that being able to bridge the gap between the two is very important. And so I try as much as possible to, not that I want to be the technologist and know the ins and outs of machine learning and AI, but I need to know enough to speak about it, to talk about how you apply it to the business and where we're seeing some of those disruptions that we can help drive and move that forward. So it's been exciting. I'm excited to see where it continues to evolve, but it's moving very fast.
I'll make one comment based on my experience, and I think we're probably running out of time at that point. One of the best things for me about being a consultant, as you mentioned, is, you know, as many people have mentioned, problem solving. You're constantly pushed to keep yourself up to date with new technologies, new ways of working. And if you thrive, if you're able to thrive in that environment of constantly evolving nature of work, then you will be very suited. You will be a very good consultant. The network that I've been introduced to, the network I've built over the last 20 years has just been amazing. There is a slight downside because I look at my LinkedIn contacts and there are people that I connected with 19 years ago because we were, you know, in the thick of a project and we got along really well and we connected on LinkedIn. But then after the project ended, we didn't really stay in touch. So there is a slight downside that sometimes your network can be very transitory. Is that the word? But on the other hand, I've made some incredibly lasting friendships. I've known Barclay for several years now, and you know, we're friends on Facebook. And as I said, I know he lives like 2 miles away from us. We keep meaning to go to a sushi restaurant that's halfway, but then COVID hit and we never got around to it. But you know, I got to know Nathan through the network. So that network effect can be extremely powerful, but there is a dark side to it. And on that happy note, I'd like to thank everyone for giving me a little bit more than an hour of your time today. I really enjoyed the conversation. I'm sure there's a lot more to unpick about some very specific aspects of what we've talked about. And hopefully, you know, if you're all up to it, maybe we'll have you back over for another chit chat about ITSM consulting or professionalism and so on.
Actually, I'm always happy to be the Nightwing to your Batman.
Brilliant, brilliant. But you know, I'm a Superman fan, so if you want to be the crypto to my Superman, that's good too.
guys.
We have to geek out once in a while. Come on, Barclay. Anyway, Nathan, if people want to contact you about anything you've talked about today or find out more about the work you do with Deloitte, what's the best way to get hold of you or to find out about that?
Yeah, through my LinkedIn profile, which will be, I think it'll be linked as part of this podcast. It's probably the best way to get hold of me. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn and I sort of blog and post very regularly there. It's the best place to get hold of me, definitely.
Excellent. And Jessica, if people want to find out more about yourself or the work that you've been doing with the government, US government and MyAcuity, what's the best way to go about doing that?
Yes. So same, LinkedIn will probably be the best place to go. So definitely look me up at JSALFA1 and you will find me there on LinkedIn. And I'm sure that you will provide the link to that to make it a little bit easier. Sure, but yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate your, you know, reaching out to me and letting me be a part of this.
Oh no, it's been amazing. And like I said, I'm really grateful that you could give us the time. And last but by no means least, Barclay, where can people find you on the socials?
Just Google me. LinkedIn, Twitter, Barclay Ray, or barclayray.com, and I will respond. Also the Enterprise Digital Podcast.
That is a new podcast that Barclay started up recently. It has been quite an interesting listen. With Ian Aitchison, correct. And for those of you, I mean, this is an audio podcast, but the way you spell Ray is R-A-E, it's not R-A-Y. So if you're looking for Barclay Ray and you look up R-A-Y, you're probably not going to find the Barclay who's speaking on this panel.
Barclay like the bank, not like the square.
You know, that's interesting. On LinkedIn, whenever I type at Barclay, it's Barclay Bank that comes up first. And it's a pain to find you sometimes. Thank you again, everyone, for making the time today. To our audience, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. If you want to pass along any feedback, please do comment on social media. LinkedIn is a great place to find me, or you can email us at ask@axelos.com. Until next time, please stay safe. Remember to wear a mask and wash your hands.
Presented by Axelos.